one of AE Sucks. Give us a ring right now, 704-549-9000, or pledge online at WFAE.org. And thanks.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Voters all over the country have been choosing their party's nominee for president, often making some surprising decisions. Well, now it's North Carolina's turn. Tomorrow is primary election day. We've moved it up from May so that our citizens would have more of a voice in the process. Though, once again, this year, the earlier primaries have substantially reduced the field, and tomorrow it may all come down to Ohio and Florida. Still, there are other races on our ballot, including those for governor, U.S. Senate, and $2 billion in bonds. We're going to go through it all this hour as we come to you live from Spirit Square's McGlohan Theater. Some of the questions and comments will come from people in our audience, and of course, listeners can also join us in the usual way at charlottetalks at WFAE.org, at WFAE on Facebook, or Charlotte Talks on Twitter. And joining me on stage is Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of political science and provost at Catawba College. He also writes for WFAE's Party Line blog. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Dr. Susan Roberts is here. She's an associate professor of political science at Davidson College. Welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Kerry Haney drove all the way down here from Duke University. He's an associate professor of political science and African American studies at Duke University, where he's also director of Duke's Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Gender in the Social Sciences. Thank you for being here. Welcome back.
Very good to be here.
And also with us is WFAE's political reporter, Tom Bullock. Thank you for being here as well.
Always a pleasure, Mike.
That's our panel. So given what's been happening in primaries around the country and where the race stands today for president, does North Carolina matter tomorrow?
It matters in that the sense of it's not so much the voting per se, but it's more about the delegate count. And I think for the Republicans, it's much more the battle of the delegate count than it is for the Democrats right now. Hillary Clinton, even though with the pledged delegate support, has a commanding lead because of the superdelegates in the Democratic Party.
How many superdelegates do we have in North Carolina?
Oh, boy. I think 14 or so superdelegates and 72, maybe, pledged delegates from North Carolina. The pledged delegates will be awarded proportionally, along with the Republican delegates will be awarded proportionally. But the key states that you mentioned, Ohio and Florida, are winner take all. And so this is where the real battle on the Republican side to get to 1237 is really crucial, I would say.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the stranger things that happened when the legislature moved up our primary is they left North Carolina not a winner take all. The delegates will be proportional. So you could literally have someone like John Kasich or Marco Rubio, who have really not campaigned in North Carolina, still potentially getting a slice of that delegate count. But really what it boils down to, I think we'd be getting a whole lot more attention if it wasn't for the fact that for Governor Kasich and for Senator Rubio, it is a must.
Do or die.
It's do or die for their campaigns, all based off of Ohio and Florida.
There are 107 Democratic delegates, I think, in North Carolina and 72 Republican delegates. The Democrats have the superdelegates. The Republicans do not. And the Democrats have superdelegates, as I understand it, because it gives the party a chance to
stop an insurgent campaign. Basically,
remember, yeah. they maintain control. They right. Soften the edges of the effects of the vote. The Republicans, are they wishing they had superdelegates?
I would think that they are wishing they had superdelegates. After Ron Paul, they instituted something known as the eight-state rule, in which when they get to the conventions, maybe on the second round, I'm not sure, you have to have won over 50% in eight states. Now, that's really complicated. I think some of the stories are about the numbers. I would say that North Carolina is important in some ways, in that it's a question, and Kerry can answer this, about the demographics of the vote. Is Sanders able to diversify his electorate in North Carolina? Can he get voters that he hasn't been getting in other states? I think it is important, too, because The legislature is getting more than they bargained for. This is one of the longest running Republican nominations that you've seen. This is competitive, and it's gone on longer than I think most people would expect.
Yeah, I think Susan's exactly right about the Democratic side. Senator Sanders, I don't think he has a chance to win the nomination, but he has a chance to shape the contours of the race, especially for Hillary Clinton. Some weaknesses have been revealed in previous contests, and if he can continue to show well and outside of the Northeast, that puts more pressure on Senator Clinton and the Democrats come November.
Well, he surprised her in Michigan. Could he surprise her here?
I think so. I think it's a setup for him to surprise her with young voters in the state and momentum behind him coming out of last week's campaigns.
And there's a double-digit lead in North Carolina, but they're doing as the Clinton campaign is doing as it has before, lowering expectations. We think it's going to be tight so that they're not going to be, you know, surprised, and they won't be publicly humiliated or taken to task. I think that she's been lowering some expectations. So when you win, oh, yes, we won North Carolina. It's important that we win North Carolina.
And there are some parallels when it comes to Michigan here in North Carolina, parallels that are different than, say, what happened in South Carolina. And it all comes down to that manufacturing base that this state once had, a much stronger manufacturing base than it does now. Now, with African-American voters, they still are firmly Hillary country. That is still firmly in the Hillary Clinton camp. And I believe in South Carolina, she won that by, I think, 60% or 70%.
Yeah.
So here, though, you still have a very strong, very active, very important African-American voting bloc. But if Sanders can translate that what happened to our manufacturing jobs into North Carolina, something he didn't do down in South Carolina because their manufacturing jobs are, I mean, they're adding a lot of manufacturing jobs on a regular basis. You know, he erased a 21-point deficit in the polls in Michigan. Now, she's definitely leading here, and I think it's right around 20%. I'm not saying that it will reverse, but if he there is the right mix to see that kind of race tightening and a potential surprise.
And in North Carolina, particularly with the early voting, we know that at least 40% of the ballots requested for early voting on the Democratic side are from African Americans. So we would expect that to be a help to Hillary Clinton. If you look at the age, though, 35% of early ballots were requested by people under the age of 50, so millennials and Gen Xers. And that is almost the interesting divide that I'm seeing in throughout all of these primaries, is strong racial politics behind Hillary Clinton, but this dominance by Sanders, a 74-year-old candidate who is bringing in millennials into this process. That's the really fascinating mix that I think North Carolina could potentially play out.
You've done a lot of studies on the demography of all of this, Dr. Haney, and why is it that Bernie Sanders, who did take part in the civil rights movement and who has policies or planned policies that would affect and positively affect a lot of people in the African-American community, why can't he gain traction with those folks?
I think it's a matter of history and longevity. Bernie Sanders is new to the national scene. Hillary Clinton's been around as First Lady, as Senator, Secretary of State, and associated the association with her husband, who some often refer to as the first African-American president for some of his his policies. So, and also with Bernie Sanders, right, I mean, the African-American vote is a mature, sophisticated vote. It's not enough just to have the platitudes and the promises. People look for what have you done. And when you look for what Senator Sanders has done, not what he's advocated, but what he's actually done, the record's quite thin, and I think people see that and choose differently.
Well, and I think, too, in North Carolina, I mean, excuse me, in South Carolina in 2008, there was talk that some African-American women were having to think about whether to cast their vote for Obama or Clinton, because there had just been, as you say, the kind of Clinton is the first African-American president. I also think that for the African-American voter, let's look in South Carolina, there was such an appeal and there was such a discrepancy that was almost mind-boggling between Hillary Clinton's vote for the African-American vote and then Bernie Sanders showing. And I think Bernie Sanders has just not been able. He goes into South Carolina, and you're just thinking, he's going into South Carolina, and he's labeling himself a Democratic Socialist, and he's going with Cornel West, a noted intellectual on the left side. It just didn't make much sense to me to campaign that way in South Carolina.
Right.
And I think that's been toned down some, but I think that label doesn't play well in the South.
Let's look back to manufacturing for a second, because in 43 minutes now, Donald Trump will be appearing at Lenoir Ryan College in Hickory, which was the center of furniture manufacturing in this state for a while, for a long time. Is that why he's there? Is that why he was in Cabarrus County in Kannapolis last week?
I think it's less about where the manufacturing jobs were and where the Republican votes are. I mean, let's face it, Charlotte is not exactly a deep red city, but the suburbs are. The suburbs have the votes that he is courting. So go where your voters are. Go where your supporters are. I think it actually makes a lot of sense for him to go up to a place like Hickory when you had yesterday Ted Cruz at the Charlotte Motor Speedway. It's if you look at Donald Trump's stops, just in the last little bit here in North Carolina, it's Fayetteville is really the only big city that he is that he came to.
Today, Hillary Clinton will be at the Grady Cole Center tonight at 7:30, and Bernie Sanders will be at the PNC Music Pavilion at 1:30. And to the best of my knowledge, this is the first time they've made public appearances in this part of the state. They spent a lot of time in the Triangle last week. Why? This is the biggest city in the Carolinas. Why are they thinking that their appearances in upstate South Carolina for the South Carolina primary holds them in good stead in the Charlotte region? Why weren't they here?
There's some spillover from the media market. So certainly folks in Western North Carolina got when the South Carolina primary, they got inundated with the advertising and the appearances. But certainly the major media markets, Charlotte and then certainly the Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill area, that's where a majority of votes are coming out of. When we talk about North Carolina in general elections, basically it's 13 counties will deliver 50% of the vote.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as Barry Goldwater said in 64, you need to go hunting where the ducks are, and the ducks are in the major urban areas. But North Carolina has also become kind of bifurcated in that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders will come to major urban areas. Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, others will go to the rural areas because that's where the Republican strength is as well.
You can also go, when you go to Mecklenburg County, it's expensive in terms of a media market, but it's also free media that they get for coverage for coming. Now, that's no consideration for Donald Trump, but the free media does make a difference, and we're having headlines, also headlines around the state when there have been more protest for Donald Trump, none at the Clinton-Sanders rallies.
I do think, too, that there's a tactical move here, and it all boils down to the obvious, millennials, college students. You know, I think, frankly, having Bernie Sanders go to the, you know, Raleigh and Durham makes a whole lot of sense for him because there's a higher concentration of college students there than there are, say, in Charlotte. So it also makes sense for Hillary Clinton to go there to try to push back that wave as a way to, you know, kind of shore up her base, her supporters there.
Yeah, and I also think the reason why Senator Clinton, Secretary Clinton, would move outside of the major market in the North, in the Research Triangle area is precisely that Bernie is competitive there and coming elsewhere to look for every vote and getting the turnout everywhere.
And when we come back, I want to talk about the millennial voters and the double whammy of spring break and voter ID on Charlotte Talk.
Thanks for tuning into this special pre-primary edition of Charlotte Talks, live from Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater. We'll get back to the conversation in just 90 seconds, but support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Henderson Properties, providing HOA and condominium association management throughout the entire region for over 25 years. HendersonProperties.com. Good morning. I'm Wendy Herkey, executive producer for Charlotte Talks. I'm here with Jeff Bundy from WFAE, and we're glad to bring you this Charlotte Talks special from McGlowan Theater. This is a great example of the great things we're able to do with your membership support of WFAE when you call 704-549-9000.
That's right. We are in the midst of our spring membership campaign, but you know, knowing that a strong journalistic voice is important for democracy and in advance of the primary vote tomorrow, we thought that it was more important to use this hour to really focus on the live event from the McGlowan Theater with Mike and his guests. We're hoping that you will come on board right now with just 30 seconds. We're not taking a long time to ask for money because, again, we want to focus on this important discussion. So please take a moment right now. Give us a ring at 704-549-9000. You can also pledge online WFAE.org. No matter where you give, no matter how much you give, please know that we sincerely appreciate your support. Coming back to the show in just a few seconds here, 704-549-9000 or WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're live from the McGlowan Theater at Spirit Square today with Dr. Michael Bitzer, who is the provost and a professor of political science at Catawba College, Dr. Susan Roberts, associate professor of political science at Davidson College, Dr. Carrie Haney, associate professor of political science at Duke University, and WFAE's political reporter, Tom Bullock. We're going to begin this segment with a question from someone in our audience here at McGlowan. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm Bonnie from Charlotte, North Carolina. I just returned from volunteering on an army base in Israel, where fellow volunteers from several countries asked, what the hell is going on in the U.S. elections? I didn't have an answer to the question. What would your response have been?
Civil war.
I was in Germany and Poland this past week and got asked the very same question. And in particular, they wanted to try and understand what is fueling Donald Trump. And I think that's the big issue.
Interestingly enough, didn't Germany just have an election in which the extreme right wing had great success?
Well, there is the rise, and I'm not an expert in European politics, but right. but I know enough to be dangerous. But there is a growing authoritarianism, strong nationalism strain that has always been in Europe, but it's starting to grow and manifest as well. And I think what helps me to understand the Donald Trump phenomenon is he is giving voice to people who feel they have no voice. Society is changing. Things are developing around them that they don't feel comfortable with. And what he is doing is being able to give a message and a voice to that discontent of economics, racial, generational, all sorts of things going on.
But what is interesting is that the people who make their living in politics, both on the Republican and the Democratic side, behind the scenes, the pundits you see on television, the people that work for the parties, the people that work for candidates, are clueless. They didn't see this coming at all.
No, that's what you see in a lot of the articles, that the Republican Party should have recognized this a long time ago, and not just with the Tea Party, and looking at the Freedom Caucus in the Congress, that this discontent and the majority of the Republican Party, the white male voter. And I think it's disappointing to see it come to that. And as Michael was saying, there are people in Germany, there was an article that Trump is, quote, the most dangerous man in the world. And I think the message is really not there. It's just not even the personality. It's the vulgarity. It's the political narcissism. It's all these characteristics of the candidate that really may, and if you've been abroad, Michael, you might be able to address it recently. That's what's, I think, capturing the attention and the amazement of the international community, because he is so flamboyant, and the language and the political rhetoric is so crude.
Yeah, I think there is a connection between what we see in Europe with the far-right parties advancing and Donald Trump. And it's the same common denominator, and that's race. Since the election of Barack Hussein Obama to the presidency, we've seen this kind of tension. Even before that, we go back in 1964 in the Goldwater campaign. What we see now is the culmination of what began at least that far back. President Obama being elected, there's been now some growing tensions that are now coming to the surface. You see that in Europe with immigration of African and Middle Eastern immigrants coming to Europe. We see a reaction of the right. I think what we see with Donald Trump is something very similar.
Let's talk about, we'll come back to that, but let's talk about the double whammy of spring break and voter ID, because these major primaries are happening at a time when kids are on break. And Bernie Sanders benefits from the youth vote substantially, and particularly in North Carolina, a lot of five counties. I have this on the back page here someplace. Five counties are making some college students cast provisional ballots because they didn't have the proper voter ID. They are Durham, Orange, Watauga, and Wake, where colleges exist. So talk about that for a second, because a lot of these kids, are they being disenfranchised? Will it impact Bernie Sanders substantially?
Oh, it certainly will. It's a double whammy. I mean, the one whammy is that it's spring break season among college campuses and students are gone. Now, on my campus at Duke, we had a polling site this year that we regained after it was taken away. Mm-hmm. And so if students didn't vote early, they're not in town to vote on Tuesday. They're in Florida and Cancun or wherever they go. And that hurts Bernie Sanders. That's his contingent. And the ID, many of our students are from out of the state. Mm-hmm. They may not have what the state requires as a legitimate ID. So if they cast a vote, it's no guarantee that vote will be counted. If they have a provisional vote, my college students, you know, they're not going to come back and turn it in after they tried once. They're not going to, many won't go back and.
What happens when you cast a provisional ballot? What happens to the ballot? What happens to the votes on the ballot?
My understanding is that that ballot is provisional until such time the person who cast it goes to the Board of Elections mm-hmm. to verify that she or he has proper ID. I don't know what the time frame is to do that.
We don't either, actually. What it boils down to is they will be told, the voter in question will be told, you know, by this date you need to come back with a proper ID. But let me just ask one thing here really quickly. And what you said about spring break is absolutely key. How many – raise your hand, people in the audience, if you ever, ever thought in your lifetime that a major political candidate for president would have – basically, their campaign all a flurry over spring break fears. Well, I'm guessing the answer is no. And that really shows you, again, the power of a youth vote that, frankly, has really gone either ignored or just did not take full effect of itself until the last two major, I would say, presidential elections. First with President Obama in 2008 and now with Bernie Sanders. And with when it comes to the voter ID, again, I'll ask, raise of hands, how many people here have full understanding of when and how you can cast your vote and if you need ID. I'm glad to see some hands have gone up. It is worth noting for everyone that you do have the right to sign an affidavit at the polling station if you do not have what is deemed a proper form of ID. But that, you know, basically you can use any – there are eight official reasons that you can not have an official ID. They're very broad. It can be – my work schedule did not permit me to get one. It could be I did not have transportation. It could be family care issues. But your vote then, you can cast a ballot. But again, it's provisional, which means it is not counted until you provide that proper ID. So it's this weird kind of middle ground that the legislature moved to because of fears of litigation.
Well, and also, too, it's always been difficult for students to cast absentee ballots. And if we talked about the spring break, there was an article, Bernie's Spring Break Blues, and it was really talking about how this is something that might have, you know, really have an impact on those younger voters. Much of his support has come from hashtag activism, and I was looking into his hashtag activism, Babes for Bernie, and it really is, I thought that was a little bit offensive, but it is one of those things that I think students don't want to take the extra step. One article recently said North Carolina was the epicenter of voter confusion with all of these changes. And I think sometimes if we look in the audience here, you know, what does it take to get on the ballot? I went to vote first day, early voting, and it seems that there was a little bit of confusion, and the person that took my ID looked at it a little longer than I felt comfortable. I thought, gee, did I change my address from where I used to live? And I think, you know, this has probably gotten easier. But I think most people say exactly what do they look for? I've got my photo ID, but do I need more? Do I need a utility bill? And I just think we're right. It's going to have an effect on the younger voter and maybe the other demographic that seems to, at least the impact, is to disenfranchise some of the demographic that would help the Democrats, the African-American voters, the older voters, those that don't have transportation to the polls.
Yeah, let me say that, and this is just not a one-off kind of event. If you make it difficult for young voters to vote today, they may not come the next time around. They may not even bother. Yeah. I think that's part of the strategy. I think it was part of the intent in making it difficult was to shrink the electorate. I think that benefits Republicans. I think they believe that benefits them. So part of this disenfranchisement is political strategy to shrink the electorate that they think will give them some advantage.
Let's go back and talk about anger in the electorate. We haven't seen the kind of anger that we're seeing now since, I think, the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, where they rioted in the streets and Dan Rather was hauled off the convention floor on live television. Last week, a protester at one of Donald Trump's rallies in North Carolina was cocked, I mean, punched in the face by a supporter who's now been arrested. And Donald Trump, although he says he's not responsible for this, says things at the podium that indicate he might be encouraging it. And in the paper this morning, it says he may be paying that guy's legal fees.
Yeah. That's right.
What's going on here? What does this say about the future of democracy in this country if the electorate are baiting each other at rallies and wanting to get into fights with each other?
Well, I will say one thing, and I'd like Carrie to talk about it as well. Additionally to this kind of economic anger, and recently an Elon poll showed that jobs, the number one concern of North Carolina voters. It's also very unfortunately that, you know, by 2040 or 2050, the United States will be a majority-minority country. And I think that threat of kind of racial, that we've never been, whites have never been as a country, the second tier, the majority. And I think that's one reason, too. It's not just the economy anger. It's also some racial overtones, if not more. And I think the anger
But since you can't stop the tsunami, why not learn to live with it?
Well, but they don't want to see the society change as much as it is going to happen. I mean, the Republicans after 2012 did an autopsy of why they lost. And they said, we need to become a broader party. We need to openly recruit and go after minority voters. We need to go after younger voters. We need to stop talking to older white men.
Do any of that?
Guess no. Guess who your leading candidate is as front runner, who's not talking to minorities, who's not talking to young people, and who is expressly campaigning towards older white men.
And you've questioned the viability of the Republican Party going forward.
It's incredible. If you look at just voter registration statistics and look at folks under the age of 35, the number one group of registration is unaffiliated and then Democratic, and something under 20% are registering as Republicans. If I was the chair of the Republican Party of North Carolina, I'd be looking at those numbers going, how do we win unless we stack the deck in our favor?
And stacking the deck is what's happening in terms of drawing congressional districts and legislative districts and preventing people to vote.
Kathleen from our audience has a question. I know you want to talk, Tom. I'm sorry, but I'm a Democratic-leaning independent voter. This goes to your what you just said, Dr. Bitzer. I could live with a Clinton, Sanders, or Kasich presidency. Which Republican candidate could block Donald Trump, who I feel is dangerous for our country?
Well,
this is a Democrat independent. She wants to know which Republican candidate can.
Well, that is the number one question right now for what is now colloquially being called the Republican establishment. And you're seeing things that you would never see any other year. You're seeing super PAC money. I mean, literally millions upon millions of dollars being spent from a Republican super PAC against a Republican candidate in Donald Trump. You're seeing Marco Rubio's communication director over the weekend openly telling Rubio supporters in Ohio to vote for John Kasich. You're seeing all sorts of things try to line up against what has been to date a Donald Trump tsunami. And I'm not sure a lot of it is actually effective for this simple reason. What is Donald Trump's brand? What is his allure? Big part of it, I am the outsider. I am not who the establishment wants. So when you have Mitt Romney, the 2012 nominee, coming out and saying, this guy is not for what I stand for, that may be very well and good for fans of Romney and Mitt Romney himself. But for Donald Trump supporters, it seems to me this just reinforces their idea that their guy is different somehow. Fill in the blank yourself. You know, that's what they're doing. I went to a Donald Trump rally actually in Concord, and I have to say, if you break it down, and before I'm going to put a caveat on here just to make sure everybody knows, primary stump speeches are not full of a lot of stuff, right? There aren't a lot of policy points. You're not going to get a great lesson in civics or how to run a democracy. What you get are catchphrases. What you get are general ideas. And really, politicians rely on the audience to fill in the blanks themselves. That's what brought you to that rally in the first place. But I have to say, a Donald Trump rally is spectacular in how little is actually said. You know, you sit there and you listen, he'll tell you, the Chinese love me because I have real estate interests there. You know, I will get Mexico to pay for the wall because I am a great negotiator. There aren't a lot of policy points that you will find, but the audience is more than happy to fill in the blanks. And they do so for one reason this is what I wanted to get to, Mike. You know, we talk a lot about protesters. You know, I'm a big supporter of freedom of speech and protest by all means and for whatever moves you. But have no doubt that protests are baked into a Donald Trump rally. He is relying on them. Mm-hmm. He actually joked to the crowd in Concord that if he didn't have them, he would pay to have them brought in. He said it was because it's the only time the television cameras show the size of the crowd. But there's more to it than that. For candidate Donald Trump, to fill in the blanks about candidate Donald Trump, you need a sign of strength. That's his entire thing. I'm a strong guy. I'm going to get things done. And the way people are filling in that blank is by watching him deal with protesters. And my fear is that we're going to actually see more protests and more violence, potentially, if he continues on this gravy train of delegates that he's been feasting at.
Very quickly, the voter turnout of early voting in North Carolina has been record-setting. Yeah. Are we to assume that will carry over into tomorrow's election in terms of voter turnout, and who does that benefit?
I think it helps Donald Trump on the Republican side. They're up to over 300,000 early votes coming in. And interestingly enough, 28% are from registered unaffiliated voters. And his main campaign speech has been, I've been willing to bring in new people, and most of those new people are white males.
Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump seem to be two sides of the same coin. Yeah. Does it benefit him on the Democratic side?
It could potentially, but the numbers just seem like, you know, the younger the voter, the more likely Sanders. But we're seeing a respectable percentage of African-American voters coming in.
And Trump claims he is bringing, as Michael said, these unaffiliated voters. He said, I'm bringing them to the Republican Party. He is not bringing them to the Republican Party. And as Tom said, his speeches, he will say things that are ludicrous. I'm a uniter, not a divider.
But he did bring unaffiliated former Democrats in Michigan to Trump's camp. It is worth saying.
We have to take a break. There are other races on the ballot tomorrow, and we'll talk about them when we come back.
Thanks for tuning into this special pre-primary edition of Charlotte Talks, live from Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater. We'll get back to the conversation in just 90 seconds, but support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Henderson Properties, providing HOA and condominium association management throughout the entire region for over 25 years. HendersonProperties.com. Good morning. I'm Wendy Herkey, executive producer for Charlotte Talks. I'm here with Jeff Bundy from WFAE, and we're glad to bring you this Charlotte Talks special from McGlowan Theater. This is a great example of the great things we're able to do with your membership support of WFAE when you call 704-549-9000.
That's right. We are in the midst of our spring membership campaign, but
You know, knowing that a strong journalistic voice is important for democracy and in advance of the primary vote tomorrow, we thought that it was more important to use this hour to really focus on the live event from the McGlowan Theater with Mike and his guests. We're hoping that you will come on board right now with just 30 seconds. We're not taking a long time to ask for money because, again, we want to focus on this important discussion. So please take a moment right now. Give us a ring. It's 704-549-9000. You can also pledge online, WFAE.org. No matter where you give, no matter how much you give, please know that we sincerely appreciate your support. Going back to the show in just a few seconds here, 704-549-9000 or WFAE.org.
WFHE, I'm Mike Collins from the McGlowan Theater at Spirit Square with Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College, Dr. Kerry Haney from Duke University, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. We were going to begin this segment with another listener question.
Good morning. I'm David from Charlotte, and I would like to ask the panel for their perspectives on the idea that current events may signal the unraveling of the Republican Party.
There's not just a civil war. There's World War III going on within the Republican Party, in my estimation. You know, we can point back to 64 and the Goldwater insurgency, the hard right conservatism against folks like the Nelson Rockefellers and whatnot. But this is a level of anger.
Yeah.
That I don't think Republicans have experienced, but Democrats certainly did in 68. I mean, there was that anti-establishment, anti-elitism within the party that has just blown things through the roof. And I talked to a lot of Republicans, and I asked them, they're fairly moderate, they're fiscally conservative, maybe socially moderate. And I asked them, are you willing to vote for Donald Trump? And they say, either I will stay home or I will skip the top of the ticket and vote down ballot. And that is just, I mean, these are hardcore rock, you know, red rock Republicans making that statement.
I think, too, just to be brief, we have really complicated problems such as immigration reform that Trump is offering a very simple, yeah, biased solution. So I think part of it is the problem and the make America great, and he's telling it like it is. People are responding to that.
Another listener question, though. A Republican, I have tongue-in-cheek called myself militant center for many years. With the two parties diverging so much recently, how do we get the center to be more vocal and activate the center to vote in primaries where most of the North Carolina races are decided and pay less attention to wedge issues?
The problem is that centrists don't vote in primaries. It's that simple. You know, the fact of the matter is, at least in North Carolina, we have what's known as a semi-closed primary, which is a fancy way of saying that if you're a registered Democrat, you will only get to use a Democrat ballot. If you're a registered Republican, you will only get to use a Republican ballot. But if you're an independent voter, you get to pick one or the other. The primary system is run by the parties, but the primary system itself is encouraging this push to either party's fringe, I would argue, because they tend to be the people who most reliably vote. If there was a mass voting moment for the great American middle, the primary would look significantly different.
One thing that's new to this is that the mass media and social media. Mm-hmm. You know, we've always had voters at the extreme in the primaries. It's much more difficult now to come from the extremes to the middle at the general election because everything you say now is not only instantaneously received all over the country. You can't now run in North Carolina one way and go to California and run another way. Well, you used to be able to do that. You can't take an extreme position now in the primary and then hope to be able to move to the center. Everything's recorded. People will see it. They've heard it. And it's more difficult to move off those extreme positions in the general election.
I think, too, this election has made pundits as well as political scientists say, I don't know, because it has turned our model of the partisan and the primary voter on its head. Usually the primary voter was higher socioeconomic background, party elite, wanting to control the nomination for electability, and that's just no longer the case.
Well, we have now reached the lightning round. We have a lot of territory to cover in races other than the presidential race. Pat McCrory faces two Republican challengers in the primary tomorrow for governor, Robert Brawley, a GOP GOP maverick, an outspoken critic of the I-77 toll lane project, and Charles Kenneth Moss, a Randolph County Republican making his second run in 4 years. Are these serious challengers to the governor?
No.
No, the toll road's important, but the message is there, but the messenger is not.
But the message may be, and I know Dr. Bitzer and I are going to be working on this tomorrow night when we cover the primary. What to watch for there is not Robert Brawley pulling off a surprise upset. Not going to happen. But to watch what happens in North Mac County, yeah. To watch what the votes are in places like Davidson and places like Cornelius, we may get a sense of if McCrory is vulnerable in what has long been a reliable Republican.
Well, there are a lot of people up there angry about the I-77 toll road and the governor's seeming support or lack of support for the people who are against the I-77.
Interesting choice there.
Yeah. And also recently his coming out and saying that the Charlotte LGBTQ ordinance is probably legal, but it shouldn't be. Will either of those two issues impact him at all in this region of the state where his support has been important to him?
Well, he won that North Mecklenburg pretty convincingly, outperforming Mitt Romney in a number of those precincts. I think the I-77 issue layered on top of now they're in the new congressional districts a strong Democratic district, so they basically are locked out of having a congressional representative who is a Republican represent them. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be curious to see. I think the impact is going to be there, but that's going to be a fall question.
And I think what could happen for the governor is that he could be hurt for the general election if it's not a convincing win tomorrow night.
Well, I think Michael knows this better than I do with the numbers. McCrory's disapprovals have always been very significant, more than his approval rating. And there are signs all over North Mech, McCrory and a little X through about the toll roads. Yeah. And you don't see any for anyone else who voted against McCrory is what you're seeing up there.
Now, Attorney General Roy Cooper, the Democrat in the race, has been careful talking about the LGBTQ issue here in Charlotte, but he too has a challenger, Ken Spaulding, a Durham attorney who evidently isn't spending very much money on this race. He's not a serious challenge, I take it, to Roy Cooper.
No.
Cooper says the state's gone off the tracks, most likely a reference to the Republican legislature and all the things they've been doing in the last several years, changes that were made since the Democrats lost power. He wants to increase spending on education, raise teacher pay, expand Medicaid, expand pre-K, and create a state that he describes as working for everyone and not just for the select few. Were he to win this race in November, could he do any of those things unless the Republican legislature collapses?
Right. And there you're going to have the decrease from the supermajority levels that the Republicans now possess. There are wild scenarios that you could create. Let's say a Donald Trump does have that kind of toxic down-ballot effect that could swing some vulnerable Republicans and maybe even some quote-unquote lean Republican districts to the Democrats. If Cooper becomes governor, he's got to pray, and it's probably more likely in the North Carolina State House, mm-hmm. that number decreases to where if he does veto, they don't have the numbers to override.
I think that's more likely to happen in the off-cycle election, that they can get some momentum now and carry over to the off-cycle.
Republican Senator Richard Burr is up for re-election. He's the senior senator from North Carolina and chairman of the Senate panel that focuses on terrorism. Three challengers in tomorrow's primary, Greg Brannon in his second run for the president, hoping to tap into anger at the Washington establishment, Larry Holmquist, who pledges that he will be tougher than Burr, and Paul Wright of Mount Olive, who has served for 22 years as both a district and then a Superior Court judge. Is it unusual for a sitting senator, an incumbent senator, to have two other challengers?
Well, I think in terms of the Senate races, this time around, it's just important to remember nationally that the Republicans are defending 24 seats. Yeah. The Democrats are defending 10. And Burr has been listed as one of the top 7 or 8 that is an endangered seat by Charlie Cook and the Political Report. So I think, it's maybe as Michael says, an anti-incumbent vote if you look down and see what could happen down ballot. But I think it's just one of those things in which Burr has not been, for all he may have accomplished and has accomplished, he has not been visible in the U.S. Senate.
Could Donald Trump, if he's remarkably successful tomorrow in North Carolina, impact the U.S. Senate race here?
It's possible. But North Carolina voters have a real history of splitting their ballots. You know, I could see there, you could easily play out scenarios where somebody votes for Donald Trump and then votes establishment. You know, there's all kinds of different ways that you can go. But I do want to say this. Senator Burr is up by about 28 points. So he is well in the lead. But his closest rival is Greg Brannon. And he's got, you know, he's about 20% of the vote from the polls that I saw this morning. Now, Brannon came in second to Tom Tillis. He's in the primary in 2014. He is a known name. He is somebody with name recognition. But here's the interesting thing. He is also tying his campaign to two people, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. Mm. They are also running first and second right now in all the polls ahead of tomorrow's primary. Now, it would be one heck of an upset, and I'm not calling for an upset, but I am very curious to see if he is in fact able to capitalize on running on those, and this, he's been running on these two people for quite some time. I'm curious to see if that does translate into support for Greg Brannon.
I think Burr's problem was in November, mm-hmm. and one reason that hasn't come up is the Supreme Court nomination process. The polls show that North Carolinians are in favor of there being a process, a nominee, and having a hearing in the Senate. Senator Burr may have a difficult time trying to defend his party's position if the president, and I assume he will, nominate someone soon right. for that vacant seat, and Senator Burr may have trouble in November.
On the Democratic side for U.S. Senate, there are four candidates running. Deborah Ross, former state representative who's running on economic security, and wanting to raise the minimum wage to $12 an hour. Chris Ray has a military and a mayoral background. Kevin Griffin from Durham is a businessman new to politics, which he sees as an asset. And Ernest Reeves is running for and calling for an FDR-style public works program. I've never heard of most of these people, so I'm just, why has this campaign been so quiet?
Well, I think one of the reasons, too, turning political science perhaps on its head is that there was the invisible primary in which someone would rise to the top in the primary on three factors: money, name recognition, and organization. And from what I know right now, Ross has all three things.
Yeah, very much so. And I think Democrats were struggling to find somebody. They thought they had maybe some top-tier candidates. Maybe Kay Hagan would throw her hat back in the ring. Maybe an Anthony Fox or a Cal Cunningham who had run the kind of campaigns. But they really had to kind of go into their second bench to kind of get somebody. I think the Washington establishment certainly has rallied around Deborah Ross. And this could be, you know, if we have a competitive presidential race, we will have the most competitive gubernatorial race in the country by all accounts. The Senate race is going to get impacted by those top two. And that's really going to be a fascinating, you know, see what kind of coattails play out with that as well.
I want to spend just a couple of seconds here talking about the congressional elections that are on the ballot tomorrow. Those races are completely in turmoil, and these votes won't count. But everybody I hear says, vote for them anyway. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, when I spoke with Joshua Lawson, who's the general counsel for the North Carolina State Board of Elections, the first thing he said to me is, no, I did not ever think I would be in this situation. It is bizarre. But the reason is simple. You know, when it comes to poll workers, they may get paid, but realistically, quickly trained, in essence, de facto volunteers. And the State Board of Elections is afraid that people will misunderstand that they will not vote for, say, their North Carolina House race. Or there are some precincts that won't have a congressional race because – or congressional primary because maybe their congressperson is running unopposed. So just to keep consistency and to try to make sure they don't accidentally disenfranchise someone, they're saying vote the full ballot even though the votes for U.S. House won't.
And even though these people are running in districts that no longer exist.
May or may not.
Yes.
The saga continues.
And, in fact, doesn't filing for the June 7th congressional election, which is now would have been this election, right. but it's now in June, that begins, what,
Wednesday,
the day after Election Day.
Well, and I'd be really surprised if turnout for that second primary is over 10%. I would be shocked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So nobody is going to elect a lot of people.
Well, remember the old phrase, vote early and vote often? You can vote often now, at least the congressional primaries. So cast as many votes as you want.
And there's an interesting knock-on effect because of this that's going to affect every single race. And that is, in a normal year, and by all accounts, this is anything but a normal election year, a candidate needed to hit 40% of the vote in order to avoid a runoff election. To help save money, and because of this additional primary, this congressional primary, there are no runoffs. Sure. So you literally will have winners that may pull in, let's say, the Democrats. You know, Democrats for Senate, where everybody is still going, Deborah Ross, right? You know, Chris Ray, is that it? You will see winners likely with less than 20, 25% of the vote.
There are $2 billion in bonds on the package, on the ballot tomorrow. And until Philip Dubois, who's the chancellor at UNC Charlotte, and CPCC President Tony Zeiss began campaigning last week for these bonds, I don't think most people were aware of them, and they go for a lot of things with regard to the UNC system. How likely are these bonds to pass? Do we have a track record in North Carolina of passing bonds? And we only have about 45 seconds.
Yeah, PPP came out with a poll last night. Democratic primary voters were overwhelmingly supporting the bond. Republicans were pretty much divided. They think with probably 60% of the vote, the bonds package will pass.
And it's getting bipartisan support.
It has.
Yeah. Yes.
Because the governor's supporting it, and so is his challenger in the last election, the former Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton. So they'll probably pass. So the big election tomorrow, obviously, is the presidential race. Polling has been notoriously wrong this year. Do we, even though Donald Trump's well ahead and Hillary Clinton's well ahead, do we expect any surprises in North Carolina tomorrow?
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't say the polling's been bad. It's sort of turnout is the game, right? The polls tell you who, telling you they're going to vote. Getting them to the polls is quite another story.
And you get the last word because you came all the way down here from Duke University.
I appreciate that.
Dr. Carrie Haney, Associate Professor of Political Science at Duke University. Dr. Susan Roberts, Associate Professor of Political Science at Davidson College. Dr. Michael Bitzer, Professor of Political Science and Provost at Catawba College, and WFAE's Tom Bullock. Thank you all for the hour.